My name's Tyler.
And I'm Oren.
And welcome to the Horror Pod Class, everybody. Those of you that are joining us for the first time or even our returners, the Horror Pod Class has been going strong now for almost 3 years. And typical episode is broken up into three parts. The first part, we are going to tell you about what we are excited about in the world of horror, speculative fiction, maybe a little science fiction. Second, we are going to propose an essential question about the movie that we just screened, and then run as far from it as humanly possible. But maybe we'll get around to it.
We've addressed them a time or two.
Yeah, we're getting back to the basics this season.
And probably won't next month, but maybe this month.
Yeah, I think we'll do pretty good this month, I think. And then third and finally, our question is, if we were to propose a double feature of this film and something else, we'll introduce our Four Corners segment of the episode where we give you some recommendations for stuff like Mad Love tonight. So, all right, Andrew, tell us, Oren, what's got you excited?
Well, I've actually seen new movies, which is not a normal thing for me. I saw Destroy All Neighbors, which came out on Shudder like last month, I think, or this month even, maybe, which is this very goofy, like broad comedy thing, but it's got like Alex Winter, and it was written by a guy I know who does stop motion animation, ironically enough, given the other movie I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Right.
But, and it's good fun, it's kind of like the same level as like something like Idle Hands or something, if you remember that. It's like this very broad horror comedy, but it's fun.
Okay.
And then like just last week, I guess I saw stop motion when it premiered, and it's a brand new movie from the guy who directed that Cat with Hands short from like 10 years ago or whatever, if you remember that.
Vaguely, yeah.
But it's fantastic. Creepy and well acted. It's got the actress from The Nightingale, who is fantastic in it. And it's just, it's a dynamite movie with really creepy, gross stop motion effects in it. They're really gross.
I love it. Well, everybody around Signal Horizon was raving about it. I think I'm the only one in that batch of writers that hasn't seen it yet, but sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's really good. And that horrible clown there is from it, so,
Nice. Who doesn't love a horrible clown? Wow. So, and what surprises probably no one, Second Sight has some new stuff that I want to recommend. The first is a movie that is really rough. It is a French movie called Inside. It is in the same vein of like Martyrs and right, exactly. It was a first watch for me when they sent me the check disc for it. I'm glad I can check it off the list. I will tell you what helped me deal with it a little bit was listening to some director's commentary and all of the extras that are fantastic. So check that out if you want some new French extremity in your life, if you're that type of person. And then the other thing, they have a new one, a new disc out for Possessor, which is a much more newer film. I think last time, those of you that joined us for the episode last month, we had a little conversation about Possessor and body autonomy and that kind of stuff.
Possessor actually addresses a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about like the mind-body problem and stuff that we're going to discuss about tonight's movie. So
yeah, very good. And then the last thing I'll recommend is a book. I just finished Mr. Magic, which is by Kirsten White. She wrote a book, maybe it was out last year or the year before. It got a bunch of acclaim called Hyde, which is essentially like cosmic horror if you combined it with Hunger Games. It was pretty interesting. It didn't hit the landing, but Mr. Magic is unbelievable. It's probably my favorite film or our favorite book of the last 6-8 months, with an incredible afterword that she kind of explains everything, which some authors don't do. And it was nice to get a little insight. So check out Mr. Magic.
I like the cover. I'd never heard of it before you put it on this list. But
yeah, it's definitely got like a Candle Cove if you were into that when it was out. There is a new trailer out today for a movie called By the Glow of the TV or something that is about. Yeah, it looked great. Yeah, the trailer of that movie looks bonkers, but it kind of works under the assumption of like this show that we used to watch as a kid that people can like half remember. And I think we all probably.
Okay.
Yeah, very good. That's Andrew. Oh, yeah, right. I think I knew that, which is another movie I loved. So very good. All right. Next slide. All right. How about our essential question? Go for it. No, you do it. You do it. It's yours.
Apparently, our essential question is, what can Mad Love teach us about the mind-body problem?
Yeah, this is Peter Lorre speaking.
I couldn't resist the temptation to call you. I just read of your new picture that you're to make.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thanks for your interest.
Oh, I thought you were magnificent in M.
And just the other night I saw your new picture, The Man Who Knew Too Much.
What character are you going to play in?
Oh, it's the most unusual story. You know, it's a great love drama. I am to be a half-mad scientist. I, a poor peasant, have conquered science. Why can't I conquer love? He shall be shut up when it's I who am mad. But nobody knows that. Yes. Each man kills the thing he loves.
That is, don't worry, we're gonna get into it. I told someone else that was the essential question, and they were like, I don't know what that is. And I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah, it's a true educational episode. Rarely do we get those these days. But before we answer that or attempt to answer that question, giveaway number one.
First giveaway, which you will notice if you just watch the movie with us, that this frame that I use for the giveaway is not, in fact, from the movie we just watched. It is from the silent film that this movie was a remake of, from the movie The Hands of Warlock, but it's such a fucking great still that I had to use it. So the first giveaway we're going to do tonight, you are going to get a pile of things. So you are going to get an Errol Stein book, The Boyfriend, a shitty like erotic thriller called Object of Obsession on VHS, and I'll tell you that the VHS giveaways for both of these are courtesy of the person who's going to be our special guest on the next episode, so you'll hear a little bit more about that later. You'll get a book about severed hands called The Phantom Limb, and you'll get a Goosebumps book, Horror Camp Jelly Jam, and also like a weird tiki pen.
Yeah, from Pixel Elixir. They're
that
great.
That was not thematically related.
Not remotely cool at all, but hey, you get a cool pen. So.
All right, so the last three numbers are 077.
Hey, all right, winner, winner. Come on down. Grab your stuff.
A pile of weird stuff.
Love it. Okay, so as we transition into that second phase, right, the kind of question that I always ask, and I'm going to, like, maybe ask a little additional on top of that. Why Mad Love, and what is your origin story with this particular movie?
So first, before we get into that, I want to see who all saw Mad Love for the first time that's here.
Yes. Amazing. Awesome.
Yeah. I love that. It's my favorite. So I picked Mad Love because it was February and, you know, Valentine's Day and everything, even though Valentine's Day was 2 weeks ago. I'm good at this.
It's 90% off Valentine's Day, you know? Yeah,
that's right. That's good. Yes, we are clearance. We're clearance aisle Valentine's Day. Yeah, I mean, I love this movie. It's a great, we had never shown a movie this old here yet. So I wanted to do something from the 30s and, you know, this was a kind of a classic one that not as many people have seen. Like it's not, you know, Frankenstein or the Mummy or anything. Like it's a little bit less well known, but still like a major classic. It was Peter Lorre's first American film. So he's Austrian, I believe. And he had done, or maybe he's Hungarian. I don't know. Anyway, he's from Europe. He had done some like German films. He did M, of course, which is very famous. But this was his first American film, kind of his, in some ways, signature. Like a lot of the things we come to know Peter Lorre for are already present, fully formed in Dr. Gogol. It's a movie that has a lot of crossover with the Universal Monster films, even though it was made by MGM. Like, it's got, you know, some of the same screenwriters, some of the same, it was adapted by Guy Indoor, who wrote The Werewolf of Paris, which was later adapted into the Hammer film, Curse the Werewolf.
Yeah, but I think you get the sense of that kind of universal influence on that, the kind of iconic look. I think it is no secret that you have a much broader history in older films than I. But like, I think what struck me so much, again, like a lot of the things that we look at that are older here, charming as all get out, and such an iconic look by the villain. That, like, I could see him on a marquee, like we do Dracula, like we do the kind of classic Frankenstein. And, you know, it's a real bummer that more people don't see, you know, Dr. Gogol in his iconic evil, you know. Yeah.
And he has two really dynamite looks. He's got that, like, fur-lined coat.
Yeah,
that
right.
That he wears to the opera. And then he's got, when he dolls himself up as Rolla with the, like, metal hands and the neck brace and everything.
Oh, it's so good. And he's such a good monster. Yeah. Like, legitimately is a very creepy look, right? When you, with the weird hands and everything else, it's like, oh, all right. I will also tell you, I think the one big thing that I noticed, particularly with Peter Lorre in this movie, I feel like he's got like Marfan syndrome already because his eyes are so bulgy, you know? Like, I think he's probably got some other things going on with him that help.
He's got a very Batrachian look. Like, he looks like a frog.
Yeah, yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Like,
he's very bulbous. Yeah.
He's kind of bulbous. But like, there's points in his history where he's kind of hot, honestly. Like, and honestly, not even a little bit even than this. But like, later on, he gets heavier set and looks even more like a frog, like when he's older and he's in like Vincent Price movies and stuff. Like he looks like a little toad in like a top hat and a suit jacket, and it's great. But yeah, he's got very like very frog-like features.
Yeah, it only goes to adding the kind of repulsive nature of in like I, you know, it is a movie made out of 1935, right? We get this incredibly uncomfortable scene early in the movie where I guess the insinuation is our actress on closing night has to, like, make out with every dude that's ever been in the show, right?
She gives all the others pretty chaste kisses, to be fair.
But nonetheless, right? And then you have, you know, Gogol over there who's ribbiting his way down her throat. And it's like, man. Definitely of its time. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But also, like, so you asked about my history. My history, I got a DVD set years and years ago. So, of course, I'm really into these old movies from the 30s, 40s, etc. And back then I was writing what was then a column, later turned into a couple of books about them. And so I got this set that's called, like, Fox Horror Classics, I think.
Nice.
Three disc, six movie set that had like Dr. X, Mark of the Vampire, I believe a Fu Manchu movie, this, and you know, like one or two others. And it was my first time seeing this. This was, you know, honestly, it's a really good set. Like, there's at least like three legit classics, and then also a Fu Manchu movie, which
When this episode goes live, we'll put a link for that. If you are interested in movies like this,
I'm not even sure it's still in print, but
that'd be a bummer.
If it is, it's a dynamite set. Most of these have gotten Blu-ray releases since then. But back then there was no Blu-rays. This was kind of my intro to a lot of this stuff. So, just really good, really good stuff. We've done Dr. X on the show before, or else I would have shown it here because Dr. X is one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a good one, man. I think we did that during COVID.
I think so.
Oh yeah. All right. Okay. So as we move on to this next slide, this is like iteration number, three and something that has a whole bunch of them, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the other reasons I picked this up is because I find it fascinating that we had a lot of adaptations of this particular story.
Yeah.
In the first half of the 20th century. But like, unlike, say, Dracula or Frankenstein, which have been adapted a lot of times, this one kind of stopped being. Like, you don't get a ton of later adaptations of this, whereas those kind of get recycled every few years. But yeah, as anybody who is here can see from the little timeline I put together, like there's a lot of adaptations of this French novel. The original novel is from 1920. It's French and I can't pronounce it, but it translates to The Hands of Orlok. The first movie version came out just 4 years later. It was a silent film. That's what that big hand coming down to the guy in the bed still was from. It's a pretty good silent film. It's creepy and has some cool imagery. It does not have the Dr. Orlok or the Dr. Gogol character at all. Like, that is added for Mad Love. That's the first time that whole thing appears, the love triangle and all that. Like, none of that is in the original book or the first movie. But then you got Mad Love in 1935, which it was pretty common to make talkie versions of silent films once talkies happened. So Mad Love was kind of the talkie version of The Hands of Orlok. And then we get like two more of them in the 60s, which is weird. Like, we got another movie called Hands of Orlok in 1960 and then Hands of a Stranger in 1962.
Which, a great poster, if nothing else. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Poster.
Fantastic.
Good times. And then there's actually some others, like, we'll get to it in a little bit, but Body Parts, a movie from like the 90s, 80s,
yeah.
80s,
yeah.
Is essentially a similar premise of a person who gets the body parts of a murderer. Like, it's a premise that's gotten used a lot, weirdly enough. One of the reasons I think it's gotten used a lot is that it taps into this sort of subgenre that was popular, not just with this story, but there's a bunch of others from around the early part of the century, which is, you know, transplantation horror, which is partly because transplants were new then.
Right.
Like, I did some digging around. Like, the first verified organ transplant was a thyroid. It happened in 1883.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, 1920, that was still relatively new, and we still hadn't transplanted a lot of organs. Like, the first heart transplant didn't happen until 1962.
Yeah, right.
So that was 30 years after this movie. Like, we the idea of transplanting organs was relatively new, and we didn't know what the repercussions of that would be.
Yeah.
Like,
it taps into so many things, not the least of which is the kind of body horror, like having somebody else's stuff inside of you, right? Like, that's a lot to spring on a population, be like, hey, we're going to do this all of a sudden. And I don't know, probably like all things. When there is a new development, we get a bunch of horror films and fiction that, you know.
What could go wrong?
Right, exactly.
And that's the thing. Like, transplantation saved a lot of lives. It helped a lot of people, but also it did have, you know, potential side effects. It had potential abuses, misuses, all this opportunity for people to be afraid of it and be anxious about it, perhaps more accurately than even afraid of it. And I think that comes out in the transplant horror that was really popular in, again, the first half of the 20th century, when transplantation was becoming a thing.
Well, and I think we hint on some of that horror in the movie we just watched, right? Where he, right after he takes off all the bandages, I think probably a relatively common thing is when you've had a cast on or a bunch of bandages, you look at it and you're like, oh shit, that's not how I remember it, right? Like, oh, and some of it is atrophy. But if there's anything Dr. Gogol does better than surgeries that ruin people's lives, it would be gaslighting the hell out of people, right? It's like, those are definitely your hands, dude. No, it's like, they don't look anything like that, right? It's like, no, no, for real. They are your hands. Oh, all right. So, yeah, you know, like, some of it is legit. That is scary, uncharted territory. Some of it is also, like, people don't like change.
Right. So. And it's also really cheap to do, which didn't hurt for movies at this time. Like, all you have to do is, like, put some fake Halloween scars on. It's like, oh, it's someone else's hands.
Right,
cheap
right.
effect. Yeah.
Yeah, looks similar.
So, yeah, I put together a few posters for some other other transplant horror movies. The Brain That Wouldn't Die is a famously goofy movie, but it's also very much about, like, fear of transplants in a weird way. But all the way up to The Eye, which is from, like, the early 2000s, which is about, you know, transplanting someone's eyes and being able to see ghosts now.
Yeah.
Like, we have this still running even now. And, you know, even now we still can't transplant, like, hands, actually. For all that, you know.
No, we might be able to reattach somebody's old one, but I don't think anybody's, like, going and yeah, right? Yeah. It still seems like a well, and I will tell you, the kind of stuff that I know about it lends itself to a creepy factor. Like, I remember watching the special about how when they reattach people's limbs, they use leeches as a way to, like, get blood flow from the dead part. Like, come on, man. Anytime you're laying leeches on stuff, it's automatically, I think, ripe for all kinds of horror stuff. So I noticed you didn't have Bride of Reanimator on here, I think my first time.
I only had four spaces.
That's all right. That was the first disembodied head I saw doing anything. So yeah, it stood out very,
as it were, doing anything.
Okay, so as we move to the next slide, like, I haven't seen a ton of these movies lately, right? So I kind of hypothesized maybe sort of a little bit that, like, they were side by side for a while, but I think we have seen more movies where, like, they just steal your organs, right? Like, they don't put them in anybody else other than, like, rich people.
I mean, presumably they do eventually put them in someone else, or else they're stealing them, just throw them on the ground.
I mean, yeah, it's kicks and giggles, right? If you're a tourist in a, you know, developing country, maybe that's what they do.
I love stealing organs for fun.
Right, right. It's something to do. It's experiencing the local flair. No, I have not seen Fleisch. But when I was researching, like, organ theft movies, this came up over and over and over again. I bet a German film is.
I've not seen any of those four movies.
Oh, really? I've seen I think I've seen three out of those four. None of them are brilliant films, like, any stretch of the imagination. I don't think I'll be bringing any of these to the Stray Cat anytime soon. But they're okay. And like, if we were to pose the question, what happened to all these kind of possessed limb movies? I don't know. Maybe some of them went this direction.
Maybe, yeah.
Because I really can't think of anything the last 10 or 15 years that fits with this necessarily.
Yeah, fair enough.
So my question then, as we move to the next slide, how many organs do I have to remove from your body until you're no longer Orrin Gray?
Right? That's fundamentally the question, isn't it?
All right, talk to us about the ship.
All right, so I'm going to read this whole damn thing.
Okay, here we go. Everybody strap in.
All right, how often do you get to hear Plutarch on your horror movie podcast? All right, so the ship wherein Theseus and the youth of Athens returned from Crete had 30 oars and was preserved by the Athenians even to the time of Demetrius Phalereus, who everyone, you know, knows when that is.
That was a great
time. Yeah, that was a good time, yeah. For they took away the old planks as they decayed, putting in new and stronger timber in their places, insomuch that this ship became a standing example among philosophers for the logical question of things that grow, one side holding that the ship remained the same, and the other contending that it was not the same.
All right. So
for those of you who aren't familiar, that's the origin, essentially, of the famous philosophical problem, the Ship of Theseus.
Okay, so, and in the next slide, I think you break down exactly what that kind of philosophical question is.
Yeah.
And Bring it home for me, buddy. What is Mad Love saying about the Ship of Theseus?
All right. So, yeah. So, in essence, the Ship of Theseus asks, if you take a thing, right, there's an example in John Dies at the End. Anyone seen John Dies at the End?
All right. I did not have this on my bingo card, but go ahead. Yeah.
So, John Dies at the End, there's an example where they have a hammer. So, it's much simpler than the ship because the ship gets a little complicated. They have a hammer, and the hammer... the head of it, I believe, breaks, and so they go replace the head. Then later the handle breaks, so they go replace the handle. The question becomes, is that the same hammer anymore? Right, because both pieces have been replaced. And the Ship of Theseus question essentially is that question. At what point, if you replace the pieces of something as they decay or die or break or whatever, at what point does it become a new thing? And then... in 1655?
Yeah, our boy Thomas Hobbes.
Thomas Hobbes.
Yeah, yeah.
Further complicated the question and said, okay, so the Athenians have this ship, right? And each time a board breaks or whatever, they replace it with a new board. So at some point, it's entirely new pieces. But, he said, what if they also took all those old pieces and went over and built another ship with them? At that point, which one is the actual ship? The original ship, which one's the real Ship of Theseus? And this question's relevant mostly because essentially it happens to us all the time. Every 7 years or so, all of our cells die and are replaced, pretty much, which means at what point are we a new person or the same person we were before, etc. And of course, this comes into Mad Love, in the form of the what we're going to call the mind-body problem, which is another philosophical problem that's related to the Ship of Theseus, which again suggests where identity lies, basically. It's addressing at what point is a thing that thing and not some other thing.
And I think very specifically, in a broad sense, the idea that our talent, right, our passions formulate who we are. And I think, I don't know, something interesting that Mad Love is asking, like, okay, I think an interesting bit of this movie would be, or an interesting kind of turn on the idea, would be like, what if our boy Gogol somehow manages to attach the other dude's hands to his, right? And so now he is this artist, you know. Will the girl fall in love with him because of all that?
Right.
In an ethereal right. sense, maybe it's the love that makes us all who we are.
Sure.
Okay, so mind-body problems.
So, right. The mind-body problem is another philosophical problem. It's not directly related to the Ship of Theseus, but it's addressing a similar thing. Because it asks... basically, what are we? Are we our body, or are we our personality, essentially, or our soul, if you want to call it that? But again, if we're our soul, what is that? And the closest thing we can observe is our personality, our identity. And if our identity doesn't reside in our body, why can changes to our body change it? Like if you damage someone's brain, their behavior changes. And so... again, where does identity lie? Is it in our body or is it in our personality? And can they be? Are they separable? And if they're not separable, again, if you start replacing parts of the body, at which point do you change that identity?
Yeah.
And this suggests, again, you know, he replaces his hands and changes his identity, at least temporarily. Whether that's actually a permanent change or just a derangement of his senses because of the shock, who knows?
Right. But, you know, I do think it is kind of an interesting question because, like, we know some things exist for real, like muscle memory and those kind of things, right? So if that can exist, you know, is it that, you know, far a throw, no pun intended, to, you know, suddenly be good with knives? Well, I don't know.
I mean, like, the idea that you could replace someone's hands and they would suddenly become a murderer, for example, which happened all the fucking time. In movies in the, like, 30s and 40s, like, everybody who got new hands became a murderer. Everybody.
Yeah, it was never a happy ending for the no-hand guy.
But, like, that seems absurd to us. But, you know, if you replace someone's hypothalamus, for example, their personality will change.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Or if it's damaged, like right. I mentioned before. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so, you know, while hands may not do it, certainly other parts of the body will. And, again, the question becomes, at what point are you still you?
Right, then. Or are we just a collection of biochemical data that, you know, goes into an input?
Right. Or is who we are temporary all the time, and we are transitory and a different person every so often?
Well, I would like to be a person that is about 50 pounds lighter. So seven years from now, my new iteration, like if you're listening, body, let's make that happen. But if we make things, then why can't he make a wax figure into a real person? Next slide, Andrew. Look at that for transitions, baby. So talk to us some then about the idea of Pygmalion. We get this almost feels like a Greek tragedy, right? Where he is calling back to Galatea, right? Yeah. So talk to us about that.
So the movie, I had forgotten before I showed it, before I watched it to prep. Rather, how much the movie draws on the myth of Pygmalion. So for those who aren't familiar with it, the movie does a pretty good job of summarizing it. Mm-hmm. But it's from, or rather best known from Ovid's Metamorphoses, which Pygmalion was a sculptor. He sculpted, he rejected living women as being essentially imperfect. They were not worthy of his love. So he sculpted a perfect woman and fell in love with her, and Aphrodite brought her to life. In the original myth, she didn't have a name. Subsequent sources gave her one, which was Galatea, which is what, obviously, Dr. Gogol calls his wax sculpture of Yvonne Orlok throughout the movie.
Great gag that runs throughout this movie is that like wax figure is never really the it is like twice, but like every time we get the one shot in view, it's just her with somebody being like, be still.
So most of them, this is a fun thing. Most of the time in these old movies, the wax figures are people just holding still. And the reason for that, even in like the waxwork movies, most of the time there's people holding still because the lights they had to use were so hot that they would melt the wax.
They would melt the wax,
So they couldn't, in fact, shoot and light the wax figures, so they had to have people just hold real still, or else the wax would melt.
It works. It looks good. I love it.
For those who haven't heard the story of Pygmalion or anything, it actually, this is just a fun little side note, it was the title of the George Bernard Shaw play that got adapted into My Fair Lady, so there's a thin thread there connecting Mad Love to My Fair Lady.
That's right. All right. For our musical theater fans, the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plane. That's the only line from that show. I remember.
I love that movie.
Yeah. It's high quality. All right. One of your favorite pet topics? No, for real. It is interesting and very important, I think, to this particular movie because it has one of the best intros to a movie ever, right?
Well, I mean, honestly, if you want to know the real reason I love this movie, it's probably for that first 5 minutes.
Oh, it's great. It's so good. Yeah, man. Like, you're in from that minute.
Yeah. Been going. I just want to do a... Yeah. So, yeah. The theater... I can't even do it.
Yeah,
the theater of horrors at the beginning of this movie is a pretty obvious stand-in for the theater, the Grand Guignol Theater, which was a Parisian theater, which we've talked about on the show. Like every fucking episode, I managed to find a way to talk about the
it's Grand Guignol. It's great. One of these days, we'll transform the Stray Cat Film Center into a Grand Guignol, and we'll throw blood on one another.
They did have kind of splash zones in that. Where people
got It'll be a Gallagher episode. Yeah, I promise it won't be. Don't worry.
So it was opened in 1897, and it ran until 1962, which means it was still running when this movie was made.
That's pretty rad. Honestly, that's pretty cool.
It was very famous for putting on the exact kind of play that you saw them put on in this movie. Like, these very gory, very sexual plays where women got tortured a lot. I mean, but, you know, like in sexy ways. It was, in fact, like sufficiently popular that basically, like, again, in about the first half of the century, it was a sort of a shorthand for a specific kind of horror, like this kind of what Wikipedia calls graphic amoral horror entertainment.
Oh, nice.
So what we essentially call now, you know, like slasher movies or gore movies or whatever, right. what the equivalent of those were back then. were kind of called Grand Guignol movies. Like, that's how well known it was at that time. And so, like, even though most people hadn't been to one, it had imitators that sprang up. All of those, like, an imitator in Ohio.
Sure. Of course, everybody needs some Grand Guignol.
Right? Yeah. But, like, most people wouldn't have been to one, but they would have known what it was.
Sure.
So when they saw this movie, they would have recognized the theater at the beginning, even though they wouldn't have actually been to one.
I love the little intro to the theater. We get, like, the first thing that we see is this couple, right, where the guy's like, no, come on, baby, it'll be great. And she's like, no, it's too scary, take me home, which is literally every time I try to take my wife to a scary movie. At this point, she's like, okay, fine, whatever. But, man, the first few, she was like, I don't really want to see the newest Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, Tyler.
No one does.
Yeah. I did, and then I didn't. It was fine. Yeah. That was, I think, our first date, which was sad. I digress.
But yeah, so, I mean, essentially just, I had to, you know, we had to put a call out to it in this movie because that opening takes place in essentially the Grand Guignol, and it's so delightful, and I wish that I could just spend my entire life in those 5 minutes of movie where, like, you have the little headless coach.
Oh, it's so good. Right. Yeah. It in many ways, right? Because we get the weird, like, devil head, right, yeah, guy, and then the coat check, and then I think there are a couple others.
Yeah, that's
have...
the guy at the door has, like, a bone in his hand. Yeah. Like a horrible mask.
Yeah. It reminded me of that episode, but that bit of Pulp Fiction where they walk into the diner, like the 50s diner, and, like, one of the waiters is dressed up like John Wayne, and one of them is dressed up like, you know, it was just all kinds of iconic people from the 50s. I'm like, man, they make a killing. If that was open today, maybe not necessarily even like an actual theater, but a restaurant, I'd be there every day, man. Every day.
Every day.
You should open it. I'll be there.
Grand Guignol restaurant.
I love it. Everything is bloody. Okay, next. All right, our second giveaway tonight.
All right, so our second giveaway, you get a similar batch of stuff here. You get another pen. It's a ghost. You get an R.L. Stein book that is the companion to the other book, The Girlfriend Instead of the Boyfriend. You get a very different movie, also called Mad Love. You get a movie about, or a book about, a Goosebumps book about disembodied hands playing the piano.
Can't go wrong with that.
And you get whatever the hell this is. Yeah. Dr. Cheon and the Lost Talisman.
Yeah, that's a promo disc I know nothing about. So you'll have to reach out to us and tell us if that thing is any good. So
I know what that is. So
I honestly don't either.
Yeah. All right. Last three numbers are 075.
075, anybody? Uh-oh.
And one claims it off to go to the next one.
Going once, 075. Once, twice, three times. Okay.
All right. How about 080?
Winner, winner.
You sound so excited about it.
You seem so excited to get your very own copy of the 1994 classic Mad Love.
Or Dr. Cheon.
Maybe Dr. Cheon is great, man. You don't know that. It might be fantastic. Either way, you're going to have to come back next month and be like, I watched that. It was not fantastic.
It could be mind-blowing.
It could be. Could be.
You never know.
All right, so our final section of tonight, if we were to plan a family double, not a family necessarily, but like a night double feature.
Double feature, I love one of yours. That would be dynamite.
I'm going to explain it. Don't judge me until we get there. But what are some movies that we think would go really well with this one? Oren, you start us off.
All right, so I picked a movie called The Witch's Mirror, which is a Mexican horror film from 1962. It's really good. If you've never seen it, it's kind of like if every horror movie that had been made before 1962 all got into a car wreck or something and had to convalesce together. It's just like it's got a little bit of everything in it, but including some like disembodied hands playing the piano and shit and some like weird surgery stuff. So,
okay, yeah, cool. That's good. Very good. So I tried to pick some newer stuff because I figured – you would stick with older. So I picked a film that's available right now on Hulu called Bad Hair, which is essentially like a movie about possessed hair weave, essentially.
Okay.
It is a horror comedy. It is really, really well done. It's got a really diverse cast. It was a ton of fun to watch when I caught it at the Overlook Film Festival the first go around. And I thought it would be funny to go from a film where the bad guy is bald to a movie where, like, essentially the bad guy is super hairy. Yeah, right? Like, there's some thematic unity there, my friend. Sure. Some thematic unity. Your next one.
The other one I picked, I'm actually kind of kicking myself for not picking Murders in the Rue Morgue from the 30s because they kind of look similar. But I actually picked The Beast with Five Fingers from 1946, which is another severed hand movie that also has Peter Lorre in it and piano playing. So
very good.
A little bit of everything there.
Yeah, I think that's going to have to be, because you've mentioned that two or three times to me. So I got
it. It has maybe the funniest tagline ever, which is like on the VHS box. It used to say there was like this big tagline with some quote, pull quote from a review that was like shockingly plausible.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's also not, incidentally. It's not particularly plausible at all.
I love it. The selling point is like, yeah, probably.
Right.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah, it's believable. I love it. Okay. So I picked Boxing Helena. All right. So Boxing Helena, if you are not aware, is a movie where it was super controversial, I think, at the time. I will also say I haven't seen it in 20 years. But I think it was one of those that kind of the controversy outreached the quality of the movie. So, like, it is what it is. But the central conceit of the movie is that there is a surgeon obsessed with a woman. And through a car accident instead of a train accident, he has to amputate her legs. And instead of being a normal person, allowing somebody to, like, convalesce in the hospital and, like, live a normal life, he decides he's going to keep her at his estate. And slowly but surely, he amputates her arms as well. Hence the term Boxing Helena. But all of that being said, I like the idea that it was like a crazy person that was doing crazy things essentially to keep a woman captive. And if I remember, there is like some poo-pooing towards like creating the perfect version of a woman. So he's like doing to her the opposite of what Gogol was doing.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Sure. Any excuse to mention Boxing Helena, sign me up for that.
Also, he didn't mention Boxing Helena was directed by David Lynch's daughter.
I don't know if I remembered that.
And its reception at the time
was
basically meant that she didn't direct anything else for like 20 years.
Yeah, like it is a movie that is deeply problematic, but I mean, it is a thing of that time, right? Just like this movie from 1935 is a thing. Yeah, I don't know. But it's also the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
God rest his soul, you know, also timely. So, yeah. You know, we can give him a shout out.
Yeah. Nothing else. I always love Julian Sands.
Okay. So you all are going to go run and watch Boxing Helena. Yeah. And when you come back next month, what are you going to see?
We are going to have a very special episode next month. We are going to have a guest.
Yay!
The guest is Elijah La Follette, who some of you may know. He runs Magnetic Magic Rentals. And every month he hosts Analog Sunday at the Rewind Dive Bar underneath the Screenland, where he shows movies of questionable merit off of VHS. And we're going to be showing one of his favorite movies. We're going to be showing Puppet Master off of VHS, which Puppet Master's great. We all love Puppet Master.
Yes, for sure.
And that will be March 27th, and we're going to have a blast. It'll be a lot of fun. There'll be fun giveaways, and is it 28th? Well, whatever.
Oh, yeah, March 28th.
I can't read. It's cool.
We'll be here both days. I don't know if we'll be here both days, but we won't. So we'll see you on March 28th. I will tell you, watching the trailer today, it's been a long time since I've seen that one, too. It was the first time I've heard somebody verbalize their names, you know?
So it's funny. We were talking earlier about the movie and everything. Yeah, they never say their names in the movie.
But this trailer, like, the trailer, here they are, right? And, like, the driller head guy, they give some dumb name. I'm like, you call him the driller killer.
His name's Tunneler. That's his name, 100%. Sorry.
Oh, it is.
The leech lady, they call, like, Miss Leech or something, okay, which no one calls her that ever. But
I will say, as I've mentioned on this episode multiple times,
we're going
to
talk about
an odd attraction to the leech lady, and it is still there, right? I thought maybe it was just like a weird adolescent thing.
We're going to talk about your weird thing with the leech lady.
Still a little hot. I don't know. Hey, it is what it is. I'm open with my kinks. Don't kink shame me.
No, I'm not saying we're going to shame you. We're just going to talk about it.
Like my therapist. Great. Yeah, all right. Very good. So, Oren, where can they find more of your stuff?
So I am at orengray.com and various social medias, God knows, at this point. But yeah, you can find me anywhere online, pretty much. I'm on all the social medias and Letterboxd and Instagram and all those places.
That's great. I will tell you, Letterboxd is the place to be if you like movies and like minimal contact between people, but a great way to like kill time. And I have found it a peaceful respite in a world full of like nastiness on X and everywhere else. I just like to go read people's dumb reviews of movies that I like. So you can follow me at Ty Unsel on Letterboxd. Otherwise, the kind of folks that enable us to put this on are Signal Horizon. Signal Horizon has a new pop-up bar coming here in May, at the end of May, over at the Big Rip Brewing Company. So if you like Scooby-Doo and solving mysteries, that'll be the place for you. Otherwise, we hope to see you here next month with a fuller but more fun table when we have Eli on. So until then, class dismissed.
Thanks for coming out.
Thanks so much.